WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, we will re-air some of our favorite recent conversations on this end of summer Friday. We'll hear from Joyce Carol Oates, who will talk about her new novel and give us an illuminating glimpse into her writing process. And Ralph Nader reminds us of a basic lesson from Civics 101.
A letter is the most democratic media. People writing letters to their elected officials, these cannot be censored or distorted.
Nader's new book is about all the letters he wrote to Presidents Obama and Bush that were ignored. And as Sullivan County in the Catskills prepares for a new casino approved by New York State late last year, we'll take a peek into the past of the so-called Borscht Belt, where hundreds of Catskills hotels catered to a largely Jewish clientele. But first, for all the love that Caitlyn Jenner has received for her courage in publicly switching genders from Bruce, and for all the hate that she's endured from people who just can't handle the whole trans thing, here's a third category of reaction. Feminists, unhappy with the kind of girly girl image that Jenner and some other public trans women have decided to project, identifying being a woman with feeling more emotional and loving nail polish and suggesting that their brains are different, even as Jenner did in this ABC News clip from her interview with Diane Sawyer.
So here I am stuck, and I hate the word, girl stuck in a guy's body. I hate that terminology.
Why?
I'm me. I'm a person. And this is who I am. I'm not stuck in anybody's body. It's just who I am as a human being. My brain is much more female than it is male. It's hard for people to understand that, but that's what my soul is.
My brain is much more female than it is male. Caitlyn Jenner, from her interview with Diane Sawyer. Now, the most forwarded article on the New York Times site this week begins with a critique of that line by Jenner. It's by Eleanor Burkett, the former women's studies professor and Oscar-winning documentary maker. You may know Burkett from her books co-authored with Frank Bruni from The Times, including on Catholic Church child sex abuse and consumer ripoffs. She was on this show shortly after 9/11 when she happened to be a visiting professor in Kyrgyzstan and got a glimpse into how kids from there viewed the U.S. and Al-Qaeda. She lives in both New York and Zimbabwe and joins us now. Hi, Eleanor. Long time. Welcome back to WNYC.
Very long time, Brian. I can't believe you remembered 9/11.
And that was a striking appearance. I won't go into it, but that was an unforgettable appearance by you doing that cross-cultural comparison between how people here and how people there reacted to the attacks. But you compare the reaction to Jenner and to former Harvard professor Larry Summers, who also said women's brains are different. Remind us what Summers said, and how do you compare the reactions to him and Caitlyn Jenner?
Well, I mean, Summers was speaking about why there are not more women in science and engineering, both at the academic level and in the professional level. And so he brought up maybe women's brains are built differently. And it was an incredibly striking reaction. One important female scientist from MIT got up and walked out. 100 faculty members condemned him. Alumni withheld support. And it was done not just about the science and engineering part of it, of his comment, but the notion that there's a kind of gender destiny to our brains, which is the underlying theme. And Bruce Jenner says much the same thing, and all of a sudden everybody is saying hurrah. And it's You know, it's not a question of whether or not you support transgendered rights, because I think very few of us don't support the rights of anybody. But it's a question of, are you making a mockery out of 50 years of feminism in order to do that?
Do you think Jenner, reveling in being a woman, experiencing whatever she's experiencing and with whatever difference from what she experienced when she was Bruce Jenner, do you think she was also being sexist?
Absolutely, 1,000%. I mean, what little science is sure about brains, and they're not very sure about very much, is that brains are formed by experience. And I can't imagine how Bruce Jenner would think that his experience of a highest possible level of male privilege, because to be like a huge athlete is pretty high male privilege, gives him a woman's brain. I think the issue is it's what he thinks a woman's brain is, and that's different from what a woman's brain or experience is. How would Jenner, or, you know, I don't mean to beat up on Jenner, but how would anybody who's not female know what it feels like to be a female when you say, I feel like a woman? I think what they're really saying is, I feel like what society tells me a woman is. And that's a very different issue, and an issue that feminists have been concerned about for at least 50 years.
A couple of times now, you've called Jenner Bruce, and you're using the male pronoun his. People are going to be insulted by that, not the least of which Caitlyn Jenner, if she's listening. Are you doing that on purpose?
You know, I really don't. I it's more a tick than anything else. I'm perfectly happy to call, to change the name to Caitlyn Jenner. That's fine. I don't care what people call themselves. The issue here is whether or not, in order to be advancing their own rights and their own dignity and their own respect, whether they need to step on mine. And I think the response from the New York Times would suggest many, 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 many other women is, why is it necessary to do that? Because it's pretty insulting.
You also cringed when the transgender WikiLeaker, Chelsea Manning, née Bradley, supported Jenner by gushing, I am so much more aware of my emotions, much more sensitive emotionally. So do you think Manning's experience of that, or saying it out loud, sets back women's equality in some way?
Well, I think that he's reinforcing the oldest stereotype there is among women. I mean, I think there are some women who feel like they are more emotional than men, and there are a lot of us who don't think that. And why is it necessary to pander to old stereotypes in order to advance your own rights? It doesn't. It not only makes no sense to me, but I find it really, really, really insulting.
Is it pandering? I mean, they're not pandering to some paternalistic conservatives, are they, as opposed to just describing their own experiences? And again, you describe Manning as him, so you don't fundamentally accept that these are women, do you?
Absolutely, positively not. No, I'm sorry if I wasn't clear about that. I don't accept that they're women. I accept that they do not feel comfortable as men. I accept that they might feel like what they think a woman feels like, but I have no idea how they would know what a woman feels like.
So you question...
I mean, Brian, let me ask you a question. Do you know what a woman feels like?
No, but I don't...
How would anybody who's not a woman know what a woman feels like?
But I'm not transgender and don't feel like I have those tendencies. So I don't know what a transgender person feels like.
And I don't either. And I think you just got to a major point. I have no idea what a transgender person feels like. And I don't think a transgender person should be telling me what I feel like. And I think it's really, I think it's insulting. You know, it's insulting. And again, it's unnecessary. The issue here is the oldest fight among feminists, which is we have very narrow gender constraints, much less narrow for women than when I was a girl, and I'm 68, but they're still narrow, and people feel boxed in by gender constraints. Transgendered people feel it, and feminists feel it, and we should be holding hands in solidarity to fight against those boxes, rather than reinforcing old stereotypes that were used for centuries to constrain women's ability to realize themselves.
On not feeling good about Chelsea Manning or Caitlyn Jenner saying their brains are different or their emotions are different, one type of feminism has always been difference feminism, going back to the feminist theorist Carol Gilligan and others who, you know, say women are different, better in many ways. And the point of feminism is as much to allow women to be seen as equal in their differences as it is to get access to doing the same things as men. So why not see Caitlyn Jenner loving nail polish and reveling in the feeling of a woman's brain in that light?
Well, I am totally willing. And let me be very clear. I think that Caitlyn Jenner and anyone else who wants to wear nail polish and dress as a woman and revel in what we could think of as femininity should feel free to do so. And I don't care whether the person is transgendered or not transgendered. I mean, that's the whole issue of breaking gender constraints. But what's the definition of a woman? So do you get to decide tomorrow that you're a woman because you decide you feel like a woman? I don't know how somebody would know what it feels like to be a woman. And I think it's not an easy thing for those of us who have been born as women to suddenly see these people saying, I'm a woman too.
But it's the things that they're saying about their experience of feeling like a woman that your concern sets feminism back. And so my question about difference feminism is really, is it so bad to feel like women's brains are different? Does that necessarily any more disadvantage women, or couldn't that be even a type of feminism, Carol Gilligan style, or to say women in general are more emotionally sensitive, as Chelsea Manning put it, that that's, you know, among women's strengths and differences, not unequal.
And of course, as I'm sure you're well aware, Carol Gilligan kind of got nailed for this, right? I mean, this is not an uncontroversial thing. In an environment in which those differences that Gilligan was claiming exist are often used against us.
It's always been a debate, right?
Yeah, and that's the issue, is are these things neutral comments?
But as a woman, do you not see some of the behavior of men, whether it's violence or condescension or whatever, and, you know, or lack of emotional sensitivity, and say, men?
I see it as social programming. When people talk about, I feel like a woman, I think that what they're saying is, I feel like what society, you know, you don't wake up on Tuesday morning if you live in an isolation chamber and say, I feel like a woman. Somebody has to have taught you what a woman is. And I think that's what they're saying is, I feel like what society has taught me
right.
a woman is.
Right, feel like the cultural construction of a woman. And they like it.
And I really don't appreciate anyone. And men for centuries have been telling us what the cultural construct of a woman is. And I don't appreciate any man telling me what it is. Bruce Jenner, and he was Bruce Jenner then, in his interview with Diane Sawyer, was a man. And he was telling me what my brain is like. And that is exactly like Larry Summers. And that is not meant to be disrespectful of Caitlyn Jenner or Bruce Jenner, depending what time period we're talking about, as a human being or what the decisions that Jenner made are. But the issue is, don't decide for me.
Pam in Leonia, you're on WNYC. Hello, Pam.
Hi, Brian. I've always been pro-gender. I was actually like 12 or something when I read Christine Jorgensen's book. I'm very pro-gender. However, I totally agree with Miss Burkett after I read her article, because I was really angry when I heard that transgender activists successfully got a college, a women's college, to ban the showing of the Vagina Monologues, which is a very important feminist play. And what I think is that those transgender activists may have become women, but they were acting like men, and they were trying to silence us and make our vaginas invisible.
Right, and the argument was, for people who don't know this incident, I read it in Eleanor's article and I read it in one other article. I don't have any other firsthand knowledge of this incident, that one college campus canceled the production of Eve Ensler's feminist play, The Vagina Monologues, on the basis that it was seen as exclusionary because not all women have vaginas. Includes transgender. Eleanor, do you know any more about that?
No. It was a student group called Project Theater.
What school?
I'm sorry?
Do you know the school?
Yeah, it was at Mount Holyoke.
Okay.
But it's not the only time. I mean, probably the most famous incident is the incident where the actress Martha Plimpton, who's a big abortion rights activist, was trying to advertise and promote a benefit that Sarah Silverman and a lot of people were participating in it, to raise money for Texas abortion funding. And they called it a Night of 1,000 Vaginas. And they were barraged with criticism from the trans community because the word vagina is exclusionary, and we're told that we're supposed to stop calling our own genitalia vaginas, and we're supposed to call them internal genitalia or front holes. Well, over my dead body, is the trans community going to tell me what to call my body parts?
The argument was abortion is not a woman's issue, but a uterus-bearing person's issue.
That's correct. That's correct.
Because not all women have a uterus.
Yes. I mean, the concern was among, let me see, let's try to get this straight, that you could have a woman who got pregnant but was, like, transitioning, who self-identified as a man and still needed abortion services. Well, since I think that we're not talking about a very large group of people, and Kate Pollitt did a wonderful job reporting on this, demonstrating how funding, the generosity of funders for abortion clinics goes down if the word woman is not used.
Hmm.
So now we're going to hurt the abortion rights movement, which women spent scores of years, scores of decades fighting for abortion laws to build abortion access, and all of a sudden we're not allowed to use the word woman.
Kathy in West Islip, you're on WNYC. Hello, Kathy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One thing that's been bothering me ever since I read the article is that my training is in animal behavior. And it was my understanding that there are real differences between male and female brains all over the animal kingdom, and even among primates and among humans. I'm sure this is a moving target as I learn more and more about the brain, but all brains start out, I mean, the model for all animals, at least mammals, the basic model is female. And a female animal becomes masculinized when the brain is soaked in testosterone at some point in the womb. So there are differences between male and female brains. I'm not saying that women shouldn't have the right to do whatever they want to do. I'm an old-school feminist myself, and I, too, was very disappointed to see that the version of a woman that a 65-year-old new trans woman wants to make is, you know, a pinup model. But on the other hand, I don't think we can really ignore that there are differences between male and female brains. I think that's just flying in the face of science.
Eleanor?
Yeah, I mean, listen, you know, as the caller very correctly pointed out, this is a moving target. What we know, for instance, that women's brains are smaller than men's brains. We know that the gray matter, white matter usage between men and women differ. We know that connections between the two hemispheres of the brain are different. What those things mean, they have no idea. And we also know that brains change. I mean, by experience, so the example I cite in the article is that we know that London taxi cab drivers have a part of their brain that is much more advanced than mine because they need a much better sense of direction. So what this is very hard to study because since brains change as people grow and have experiences, we would have to compare the brains of newborns. And since it's hard to know behaviorally what newborns are doing or feeling by gender, it's a very difficult part of science. And I don't think science is at all clear. Of course there are differences in brain. There's difference in brain between me and my sister. But what those differences mean, I don't think we know yet.
Peter in the Bronx, you're on WNYC with Eleanor Burkett. Hi, Peter.
Yeah, I found this article very sad and distorting so many things. I know I don't have much time. Let me just say four quick things. To talk about Jenner as, transgender people don't have it so difficult, it's kind of like saying there's no more racism now that Obama is president. This has nothing to do with the actual lives. I mean, I've worked as a psychologist with transgender people.
I don't know that she said that they don't have.
It's difficult.
Right. I think that one's a red herring. Go on to number two.
The second thing was brains, and I think the last person discussed that. And the consensus is that there is a difference, and it has to do with prenatal hormones. The third is this pitting of one group against another. It's like Hispanics yelling that blacks are getting too much attention, or vice versa. And the final thing is, I don't know what it is, what it's really like to be a man. I just know what it's like to be me. And I think I understand different specific women as well as different specific men. We don't come out in cookie cutters. Like there's seven categories, or you can't understand me because you're not black, or you can't understand me because you're not tall, or whatever.
How about, Peter, let me play a hypothetical with you. If I'm assuming that you're kind of a progressive, fairly mild-mannered male.
Well, the progressive I take, I'm not sure about the mild-mannered.
Okay, so let's say a transgender male who transitioned from female says, now I finally know what it feels like to feel like a man. I feel like John Wayne. I feel like Sylvester Stallone. I feel like Ronald Reagan. A real man. I get it now. How would you feel?
That's silly because I don't know what it feels like to be a man. We have 40,000 different impacts on us, on our history, including the biological. But they all mush together.
So would that be the same as Eleanor Burkett's reaction? Would that be saying, don't define maleness for me in terms of these stereotypes that I don't really like?
I didn't quite get that.
Would your reaction be, don't define maleness for me as, you know, Clint Eastwood or some stereotype that I don't really like as maleness? Because
well,
I'm
two
me.
Separate things. One is, don't define me in a stereotype of maleness, and the other is a scientific empirical question about whether there are inputs in humans and primates and all animals that there's a differentiation by sex. If you don't believe there are differences, then you can't say how do you know what it's like to be a man or a woman.
Peter, I'm going to leave it there. Eleanor, we just have a few minutes. Our Twitter feed is very negative toward you. One writes, why is she unable to live and let live? Trans women are not a threat to feminism. Someone else, this is essentialist hate speech. Someone else, Ms. Burkett is being very offensive to both trans and women. Why is she defining woman as based on discrimination? So is this a lot of what you're getting since your article came out?
No, in fact, much to my surprise, because it's what I expected to get, my best example would be the comment section of the New York Times was overwhelmingly supportive of what I said. I think it's, I'm sorry if, the psychologist who called a minute ago misread my article so drastically where I, to make it, that he felt that I was not taking seriously the discrimination against people who are transgender, because I certainly do. And, there's certainly no doubt in my mind that the issue here has to be people having their rights and people having their dignity. This is a separate issue. And I hate to kind of say who started it. I don't really care who started it. But when you start attacking what I'm allowed to call myself or what I'm allowed to call my body parts, it's a little hard not to elicit this kind of a reaction. And I think that people linguistically have to be very careful if they don't want to set off a confrontation. And when you say things like, I'm not allowed to use the word vagina, or I can't call myself a woman, that's where the battle for your rights begins to step on mine. And I think that's the issue, is to be very careful so that people are not getting involved in fighting against each other when there is almost always a wider fight on which we agree.
Eleanor Burkett's New York Times Sunday Review article was headlined, What Makes a Woman? Thank you so much for coming on and discussing it with us.
No problem. Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, trans and other callers respond to what we just heard. Stay with us. It's the Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. It's the Brian Lehrer show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone, as we replay some interesting recent moments. You just heard the feminist writer Eleanor Burkett giving her opinion on Caitlyn Jenner. She got many strong reactions on our Twitter and Facebook feeds as she discussed her much-forwarded New York Times op-ed that objected to the way that Caitlyn Jenner and Chelsea Manning and some other transgender women are characterizing what it means to be a woman. Listeners were getting into what makes a woman and who has standing to say what a woman feels like. So we opened up the phones to transgender women and men and non-transgender women to answer the question, what does being a woman feel like to you, and what does being a man feel like to you, and who even has standing in this discussion? First, we have Antonia in Emerson, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hello, Antonia.
Hello, Brian, and thank you very much for taking my call. I'm a post-op transsexual. My surgery was over 25 years ago, and before that, hormonal preparations. And the first thing is, everyone's entitled to their opinion, and I welcome her dialogue. But I think she said several things that might be questioned on not just sociological grounds, but on solid biological. I work in the field of human reproduction, so I'd like to offer some perspective. One of her comments was that the brain is largely formed by experience. And like I would like to point out is that is truly true, but it leaves out a lot. If you look at Bonzoni's dialogue in Cowan, one is an MD and one is a PhD. They cite clear brain differences, corpus callosum, the communication between the left and the right brain. They also cite differences in the hypothalamus, which is the organ of the brain that is basically an endocrine organ. It sends out signals to the pituitary to provide the hormones both physiologically and also for gender. And the next point I'd raise is how does she know how other women feel about being female? And how does she know how men feel about their, quote, feminine side, close quote?
So can you talk for yourself? And
yeah,
having
I mean, you've been through? I believe that I've worked on the gender barricades. I've done peer counseling. I've written about the subject. But these opinions are mine.
But I'm asking you if you can articulate at all what it feels like to you to be a woman. And would you express it in terms of different kinds of emotions you have, or even being more emotional or more emotionally sensitive, as Chelsea Manning was putting it in that quote, and having been a pre-op person, you know, earlier in your life, how different does it feel?
Oh, that's a great question. Are there changes psychologically and hormonal that most people would consider to be female? First off, testosterone is a great booster for things like assertiveness, i.e. perhaps in the extreme aggressiveness. In my own personal experience, I'm still assertive, but the idea that physicality is the possible response to a challenge doesn't exist. Two, at the basic physiological level, there's been changes. One, my skin, the beard, that ain't there. That's partially electrolysis, but also hormones. Chest hair is gone, all right? So both emotionally and just in planes physical stuff, there is a difference. I can assure you that when I laid down on my chest, on my stomach, as I was going through hormonal therapy, I felt the same pains or discomfort that pubescent girls going through puberty feel or describe. So I don't know what she feels, but I know that I went through a profound experience that changed my reactions to social conflicts or dialogue, but it also changed my physiology at a very basic level. To think that it would only affect my skin, my hair, etc., and not affect my brain when I felt, and this is important, more comfortable, all right, in my skin, probably denies a basic fact of biology. Behavior is strongly influenced, obviously, not only by experience, but also by physiology. I like to ask this question. Since we're now trying to put people in a social category, where do we put people with Wentz disease? Wentz disease is a genetic abnormality. It's a mutation for the testosterone receptor. These individuals are apparently female in every way except they are sterile. But if you do the genetic analysis, they're XY. Are they male? Are they female? That's a great question. I see them as female. The experience.
Did you say
female?
Female.
I hate that term.
Did you say female?
Yes, exactly. If you were to go up with a patient with Wentz syndrome, you would not know the difference on a visual examination unless you do a karyotype. And then a subsequent genetic analysis at the molecular level, you never would know. Also, portions of the X chromosome can be what they call translocated, removed from the X and put on another chromosome. That also changes the biology. Let's remember that the default position in most development in mammals is female. Okay? It's not necessarily male. There has to be a signal to do that.
I understand.
So if that signal isn't there, does that mean the appearance of them isn't male or, you know, female?
And you know what? I'm going to leave that question out there as the last word for this phone call. Antonia, I appreciate it a lot. Keep calling us.
Thank you so much, Brian. And sorry if I went on too long.
No.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You are adding so much value. Thank you very much. Kaylin in Westport, you're on WNYC. Hello, Kaylin.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm intersex, which, if you're not familiar with that, is having XXY chromosomes. So I kind of genetically have a high estrogen level, and I've always kind of had that way. I don't present as a woman. I present as a male. And I'm very strongly feminist. In the sense of I don't have to change who I am in any way physically to be who I am as a transgender woman, not a traditional woman. I was raised as a male. So I have that idea. But for me, the difference is very, very simply affiliation, how we affiliate as T women or as genetic women. And for me, I explored that by, coming out to many women friends who know I'm that way, but know I don't present that way.
Did you say T women? Is that a category?
Yeah, trans women.
Oh, trans, right, of course. Yes. Kaylin, thank you very much. Glace in Williamsburg, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I just wanted to express a little bit of frustration at the way this conversation is going. The way it always kind of is being made to be about a really strict gender binary, that there is, a male and a female, and there's no shades of gray in the middle. Which is something that I think the Caitlin photo shoot kind of unwittingly did, and what the mainstream media do so often. And probably the best person that talks about trans issues and is the kindest to all sorts of gender non-normative people is Laverne Cox.
Right.
She speaks so articulately about it and about, the struggles that people that are gender non-normative, like myself, that maybe don't fit into the binary, go through. And they're very real,
I know. And I think that what Eleanor Burkett fears, and I listened back to that interview and I thought about it a lot over the next few days, what she fears is the binary being portrayed in the girly girl, if I can use that phrase again, way that Caitlyn Jenner did, especially on the Vanity Fair cover, and then saying things like her brain feels different now that she's made or was making a transition to womanhood, in a way that Burkett feels threatens women equality, because difference has been used as the basis for discrimination for so long. And,
absolutely.
Yes.
And I mean, in a way, I could kind of relate to what she was saying to a certain extent. I mean, I thought that there was a little bit of transphobia creeping in, or like some things that made me go a little, oh. But I mean, if you're going to try, even the way that you were describing, like, you have to be fully transitioned, it's either one or the other.
Uh-huh.
And of course, what we know about trans issues is that there is a spectrum. There are intersex people.
Right.
There are transsexuals. There are also transvestites and drag queens,
right,
that are all kind of considered under the gender banner, the transgender banner. I mean, I identify as genderqueer, and I've had a really long and sordid relationship with gender, and,
And I'm glad you brought it up, because I think that you're right. That didn't come up in the conversation with Burkett or most of the follow-ups that we had on Twitter and Facebook, and it is one of the fundamental facts to point out about this whole realm, which is that in people's experiences, it really is a spectrum and not a binary. I guess where I ultimately decided that I think maybe that I disagree with her is that there are already, even in the binary model, there are already all kinds of women. There are women who present more girly girl. There are women who like to wear high heels, who are strong feminists and who are CEOs, and maybe she finds the look and the idea of the brain being different threatening because discrimination was based on that for so long. But maybe that's a first wave feminist standpoint that just doesn't apply that much anymore. And she feels threatened by any woman who presents with that kind of image and proclaiming some kind of difference. Here was Jenner as an example of it.
Well, I think that's true. And certainly, I've been hit up on it at times because, I'm more feminine in appearance and And some women do feel threatened by that. I still go back to Laverne Cox. So Laverne's critique, and lovely critique of the Caitlyn Jenner photo shoot, she just positioned it in a way that was even broader than gender. And just how, you know, in certain lighting with the right stylist and photographer, you can get a very artificial, beautiful images, and Laverne said that she experienced that as well. But then isn't that really just taking attention off the real issues here, which is that unless you have access to money and amazing medical care and stylists and whatnot, like, are you going to look like that? And is that important? Is it important to pass?
Do you see, I don't know how old you are, do you see a generational issue here?
I do. I'm 30, and I find it confronting to see even like people that are 20 have so much more evolution, I think, with it. They're so much more open. I mean, when I look at my own relationship to my gender, it's been very painful and very tough and difficult. And I see a lot more openness and wisdom, really, and fluidity of people like 10 years younger than me. And it certainly doesn't, I certainly haven't experienced that. Gender has been the big issue of my life, and it's led me to suicide, nearly killing myself and whatnot numerous times. It's been very painful.
Grace, I appreciate you opening up to us and our listeners. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian.
Tracy in Bergen County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, Brian. I think I just want to piggyback a bit on what the last caller said on the 52-year-old person who identifies as a trans woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a curious experience listening to your guest earlier in the week and then reading the Jenner article just yesterday. And I found myself fiercely agreeing with both of them and fiercely disagreeing with both of them.
Go ahead.
And I suppose the reason why is that people get lost in these definitions of what makes a man and what makes a woman. And I just don't, like the last caller said, I just don't think it's that simple. I think if you get lost in the nature-nurture debate or, you know, the binary, you lose the nuance. And, you know, I think that's not really a fruitful discussion.
Right. Well, in the discussion, the way it was engaged anyway, I guess part of my own opinion is that both sides have some extreme positions that come out in all of this. So maybe this is what you were just getting at, too, that Burkett has some points to make about Eve Ensler and Martha Plimpton being marginalized. You know, Eve Ensler's The Vagina Monologues, which is a very feminist play, being banned or canceled on a campus because some trans women said, well, vagina, not all women have vaginas, so I don't want that label. Or Martha Plimpton, who's an abortion rights activist, and redefining abortion from a women's issue to a uterus-bearing person's issue because the category of women doesn't only include people who could get abortions. So maybe that's going too far in telling women born women what they need to define themselves as. But then when Burkett doesn't even accept that Caitlyn Jenner is a woman, then that goes too far in the other direction because it denies someone else their own genuine experience.
Right, but if Caitlyn Jenner did not have the experience of growing up as a woman in a patriarchal society, then I can see where she's coming from.
Right.
Your guest was coming from, because it's true she didn't have that experience. So,
right.
You know, it would be hard for a cisgender woman to see a person transitioning at 65 as being a woman like she's a woman. So I don't think they're equivalent. But I would just like it if people would learn to appreciate the diversity in the community a little bit more. I just went to the Trans Philly Health Conference last week, and if you look particularly at the younger generation of trans people, they're kind of all over the place, and it's really it's alarming on the one hand, but it's really beautiful to see.
What do you mean by all over the place?
They're all over the place in terms of their presentation. You know, a lot of them define as genderqueer, so they're really sort of eschewing the binary. They're not adhering or hewing to any definitions at all. They're kind of making it up as they go along, and it changes as they get older. So, again, gender being one of those very foundational things in our culture, to see it sort of morphing all over the place, I can see how that would be alarming to people.
Uh-huh.
Who think they have, you know, think they have a handle on what makes a man and what makes a woman a woman.
And do you see it as a generational issue?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think most of the discussions we're having now, 20 years from now, won't exist. I don't think that people transitioning the way that Caitlyn Jenner transitioned, I don't think you're going to see that much longer. I think it's just... it's the way a baby boomer transitions, if I can put it that way.
Right. More into the binary, in other words.
Right, right. They're just, you know, and I guess I sort of fall into that category as well. You know, we have ideas that we learned growing up about what we're supposed to look like, and we stick to those. And, you know, it's a step in the right direction, but it's definitely not the last step.
Tracy, thank you very much. And this is definitely not the last conversation that we'll have on this topic. Thank you, our trans listeners, for calling in and furthering the conversation. We'll continue after the news with Joyce Carol Oates, who will explain why writing a novel is sort of like building a cathedral, according to her. That's coming up next as we continue here on The Brian Lehrer Show with some of our recent favorites. But first, here's the latest news, live right now, from the WNYC Newsroom. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer Show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. The new book by Joyce Carol Oates is a novel based on the Tawana Brawley incident of the 1980s. Before you ask why Tawana Brawley, why now? The choice of topic is consistent with Ms. Oates' history of writing stories about class and racial tensions, power, adolescence, and sexual abuse. As far back as 1970, she won the National Book Award for her novel Them, which dealt with race and class conflicts in a mid-20th century ghetto neighborhood in Detroit. In fact, Ms. Oates says this new novel is strongly linked to that one. The new book by Joyce Carol Oates is called The Sacrifice. Ms. Oates, thank you very much for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you.
Can you begin by saying why you decided to write a book now linked to one you wrote 45 years ago?
Well, I always wanted to revisit the scene of Them, which is basically an urban situation of sudden unrest and what we call civic disturbance, or riots, as they're called in the tabloid papers. I wanted to write about white racism and the legacy of hurt and injury and outrage and insult that just keeps coming. I finished the novel in January 2013, which is, you know, well before Ferguson and Eric Garner scandal, and so the novel, in a coincidental way, seems very timely.
Indeed. But why then write a book today, or why before Ferguson and Eric Garner? Did it occur to you to write a book about, of all things, the Tawana Brawley incident, or a novel based on it?
Well, if you read the special report of the grand jury, the New York State grand jury, in the Tawana Brawley case, you'd see that my novel's fiction. I'm not writing about that case at all. It's suggested by the phenomenon, particularly the media circus, the sort of controversy that swirled. It's suggested by that situation, but the actual novel is not mm-hmm. about her.
Right. But the press release for the book starts right out by saying that it's a story based on the old Tawana Brawley incident, and you say on your website that you read the report of the grand jury as part of your research for this. So you were trying to draw some lessons from that real-life incident to tell a story that I guess you felt could be, besides a good story, instructive to us in some way, yes?
Well, the point is that my novel is not about that situation.
Yes.
In real life, Tawana Browley was lying. It was a hoax. She wasn't raped. She wasn't beaten. She wasn't in terror of her life. My novel is about a girl, a black girl of 14, who is beaten. She has been raped. She is in terror of her life. I'm writing about a situation that's much more prevalent, much more realistic. In fact, many rape victims never even come forward. They don't acknowledge they've been raped. Particularly if this is particularly in a neighborhood or in a family situation where there's a great fear for, further recrimination against her. So I'm writing about the situation that the Tawana Browley case seemed to be about, but literally was not. And I think that my version of this phenomenon of a black girl being brutalized, I think that that is much more exemplary and representative of what really happens. The Tawana Browley case was a fluke. It's like one in a million.
What does the title of the book, The Sacrifice, refer to?
Well, originally when I wrote the novel, when I started writing the novel, I was going to write very much about the white policeman, the young rookie policeman who commits suicide. I was going to write about him, and the chapter called The Good Son is about him. And about his family, particularly his younger sister, and how they dealt with his death. And then about 2 weeks after he died, his name was taken. He was sort of appropriated from the newspaper by the people who wanted to use him to exploit his name, accusing him of having been one of the rapists of the girl. I mean, this actually happened. So I began with him as a kind of sacrifice. The novel's really about white racism and how it hurts everybody. Virtually everybody in the novel is part of the sacrifice, the whole community. I think when you are white, you imagine that you're not being hurt by white racism because it doesn't directly affect you. But in reality, we're all connected, and the racism exemplified by the brutality of the white police in these neighborhoods in which people are more or less captive, that hurts everybody.
And yet the Tawana Browley case from real life has been referred to in the news quite a bit this year because of many police officers in New York City being alienated from Mayor de Blasio as a result of the mayor's close relationship with Al Sharpton. The fact that someone in law enforcement was falsely accused in the Browley affair has made Sharpton a pariah to police officers. And they don't like the fact that in the news media, there's so much discussion about abusive police and not enough discussion about, when Sharpton's name comes up at least, the fact that a police officer could be subject to false accusation. Did you give that thought as you were writing the book?
Well, Al Sharpton's not in my novel. I have a character somewhat like him, and then there are fictitious characters also. Now, Al Sharpton is a very controversial and, I think, special case. In a novel, a character like him is what we call a trickster. He's somebody in opposition to the establishment. He's a gadfly. He's very annoying. He doesn't exactly cross the line into behaving criminally, but maybe he does, you know. He's a character in a novel we can recognize as a trickster figure. Now, in real life, there was, of course, Al Sharpton, who emerged vis-a-vis Mayor Giuliani. So you have a white mayor who never, ever, ever criticized the police, no matter how many people they killed, how many people they brutalized, or with their stop-and-frisk policies, how many people they humiliated. I mean, maybe, you know, thousands of people over the years. I don't think one can compare anything that Al Sharpton has done to some of these other things. He's never murdered anyone in a chokehold. Al Sharpton never shot anyone in the back or anyone with his hands raised in the air. So it's ridiculous.
Joyce Carol Oates, my guest on WNYC, her new novel is called The Sacrifice. I saw on your website you wrote that your research for this book included reading the 1968 report of the National Advisory Committee on Civil Disorders, the famous Kerner Commission report that followed the urban riots or civil disturbances of the 1960s. What struck you about revisiting the Kerner Commission report after all these years?
Well, I have to say that because I lived in Detroit in 1967 at the time of the riot, what we call the riot, what is called the riot. And I lived only about two blocks away from some of the looting and burning, and I could hear, we heard sirens. We were sort of barricaded in our house, just hoping that we'd get through it. That experience was so so astonishing, and at the time it was terrifying. But like many novelists, I wanted to understand the context. So I started reading about it as soon as I could, but I didn't really have access at the time. I wrote a novel called Them, which focuses on a white family and the virtually no black people in the novel. So I always wanted to go back and revisit that world of 1967, 1968, and then bringing it up to date to a city like Newark, New Jersey. The city in my novel is a fictitious city, but it's like a smaller version of Newark. And reading these reports and other books on the subject, you spend a good deal of time reading about eyewitnesses or people who had been beaten or terrified by the police, black witnesses, people talking about seeing others shot down in the street, and people talking about basically surviving the situation. So there are many, many first-person witness reports, and that is what particularly strikes me as a novelist, people speaking in their own voices.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. It's New York and New Jersey Public Radio. You also consulted the official New York State grand jury report on the Tawana Brawley case from 1988, as you said. I'm curious what struck you about that. Reading it with maybe only a more casual familiarity with it that you might have had from the news. I don't know, of course, how familiar you were with it, but I'm curious, in doing research for this novel, what struck you about reading the actual official grand jury report?
Well, it's very interesting. I actually have it with me right here. It's very interesting because it's very simple language, and obviously, the grand jury spent a long time, and maybe there are thousands of pages. I have no idea what the transcript is, but the final report is very clear. There were no injuries. There was no rape. There was no beating. There was no this. There was no that. Basically, it was a complete fabrication. What I was struck by is living in the area, living in New Jersey at that time, and reading about it in the New York Times, particularly, I was struck by how the media seized upon what would seem to have been, I would think most reporters must have been skeptical and editors must have wondered. But what seemed to have been probably an invented story got so much media attention and just became sort of astonishingly magnified. Now, why did that happen? So I look at that in the novel. But I have to say that my novel is not really about a criminal. It's not a criminology novel or sociology. It's basically about a family. It's particularly about a mother and daughter. There's a stepfather, and there's some other characters. But it's about people. It's not about these. You know, we've been focusing on impersonal subjects in this conversation, but the novel's really about actual people.
What conclusions did you come to about why the New York Times might have been so credulous at first?
Well, it wasn't just the New York Times. It began sort of slowly. In the neighborhood, it was sort of known, there was kind of a rumor that this girl had been terribly mistreated by the police, and it was just sort of a neighborhood rumor. And then it was seized upon by a character like, but not identical to, Eric Shopton. He started holding press conferences, and it began in a small way, and then it got larger, and then, you know, one thing led to another. Maybe the tabloid papers took it up first, and then the more respectable newspapers realized it was a huge subject, and I suppose they felt they could at that point and should cover it. And looking at what the media in the beginning, I think, inflamed the situation, but then later on the media maybe helped to expose it. So media, that's like a double-edged sword. You know, first the media may inflate something, but then the media can be used to investigate it in a cooler way and to look into it. But my novel is mostly about the people.
Yeah.
And as I said, I wanted to show how white racism leads to violence within a family in a neighborhood like this, and how people are, if they're divested of the humanity, you know, that they behave in ways that are reckless and unfortunate. And I did want to write about a girl who lashes out, who isn't just going to roll over and die after she's been sexually mistreated and beaten. Instead of just becoming, say, mute and depressed, she does lash out in a reckless way, and it precipitates all this tragedy.
Also about the people, you're right that this story is partly about the primal decisions we all make to protect those we love. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, yes. Well, I can't talk too much about it because it gives away the secret of the novel, which is not the same thing as the actual, what actually happened. I mean, the Tawana Browley case has been written about many, many, many times, and I'm really not making any comment on that in my novel because my characters are different people.
No spoilers from the author. Erin in Midland Park, you're on WNYC with Joyce Carol Oates. Hi, Erin.
Hi, Brian. I love your show, and thank you. I just would like to say I am a huge fan of Joyce Carol Oates, and thank you for having me on. I read your novel, Them, a couple months ago, and I just was struck by the correlations between what was going on back in the late 60s, early 70s. Forgive me, I don't quite remember the exact dates, and what's going on today. And thank you very much. I'll take your response offline. Thanks.
Thank you.
Do you understand the question?
Well, I'm not sure that there's a question, but it was a very, very nice remark. And I finished this novel in January 2013, so it's really before the Ferguson and Eric Garner case and many others. So it was just sort of coincidental. But I think we've just always had police brutality and cover-ups. And what is so alarming to us is the failure of any accountability. The police seem to be able to do virtually anything. They have such a strong union, you can't criticize them without them getting very angry.
I'm curious about, to follow up on Aaron's call, the evolution of your own thought or observations about race and class. When you look back on your novel, Them, written in the late 60s, do you think you got it in certain ways but missed it in others, or see anything differently now with the wisdom of more experience? I'm fishing here, but curious about how you might see the evolution of your own thinking.
Well, that novel was about a family also. It starts off with a woman named Loretta Wendell, and then we look at, as time goes on, you know, chapters go by, she has children and then a brother and a sister, and they become the focus of the novel. It's a white family. If I had brought in a black family, it would have been a different novel, a much longer novel, and it wouldn't have been the novel that I wrote, so in a way that's, you know, it's not realistic. But I did want to revisit that atmosphere of a large city that's under siege.
I think it's something that's also very contemporary in the public discourse, this idea that white people need to talk more about whiteness in the context of race in America, not just put the focus on black this and black that, but we need to talk about what it means to be white in America.
Well, that's true. And when we talk about for instance, NYPD and the Albuquerque Police Department and other police departments that seem to be behaving without any accountability, we really have to recall that it isn't just black people who are the objects of their the brutality. They also beat up and murder homeless people and mentally ill people who may be white. So it isn't just a race situation. It's more class. It's more like economic class.
Jack in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Brian. Thank you very much. Joyce Carol Oates, you are my favorite living author. I read and reread you, and you're a constant source of inspiration to me as an artist. I have a question. How can you plumb the depths of darkness and despair as you do over and over again and not let it affect your everyday life, or does it?
Well, thank you. That's a very interesting question. I think because it's a formal structure of language where I have a novel as a form. I know the ending. The ending may be stronger. It, excuse me. It may show people who have been brutalized, who have been terrified, but they do come through, they do survive. And so I know the ending of the novel, and it will have this formal affirmation of the human spirit. Not always, you know, and I don't mean it to be sentimental, but because it's an aesthetic structure, and I'm working each day or each hour on it, I know where it's going, so it's not so depressing.
So do you write generally by making an outline or, you know, the broad strokes of what a story is going to be, beginning, middle, and end, and then you fill it in, as opposed to writing from the beginning with a general idea and then you kind of reveal it to yourself as you go?
Well, I can't think of anybody who would write in that second way that you mentioned. No, that would be a recipe for real disaster. I mean, just writing, like getting in a car and just driving and not knowing where you're going. No, I would never do that. I don't think most serious writers would even think of doing that. I always know the ending. I know the last line. I know exactly what people are going to be doing in the last paragraph, the last chapter. I know the middle. I know, you know, the beginning, obviously. Sometimes the beginning and the ending are almost exact. There's some sort of parallel, but much has changed in between. Building a novel is like building a cathedral in some cases, where you have very, very many parts. You have a high ceiling. You have this. You have complications. You have an outside. You have an inside. But you always have a plan.
And do you try to end, if I understood your previous answer correctly, with affirmation, leaving people with a sense of hope? And do you think that in recent years, more novels have tended to end with despair?
No, it depends on what the novel is. I would never give a corny, happy ending. I don't really want to write works of fiction that are feel-good, because I think that's conniving I really don't do that, and I don't read that kind of work, and I don't watch those kinds of movies. A situation has its own integrity. Hamlet has an ending that's violent. It's extremely tragic. There are many deaths at the end of Hamlet, and yet there is a sense of affirmation because there's going to be a new dispensation and a new king. And much of what I write has a younger generation coming along. The older generation may be played out. They may literally be dead, they may be dying or defeated, but there is a sense that there's a younger generation. That was the case with my novel, Them, mm-hmm. and it's actually true in nature. It's a sort of a Darwinian fact of life. One generation may be a disaster, but there will be a younger generation, completely untested and new and with idealism. I mean, I teach university students, and it's remarkable how idealistic they are. They're extremely energetic and imaginative. And whatever we've done, whatever their older generations have done to devastate the world and the environment, the younger people still have their own hopes and their own aspirations.
Last thing, I read on the Wikipedia page about you that you moved at one point from writing your journal on a typewriter to writing mostly emails, to write what is in effect your journal, but that you still write your books longhand. Is any of that true?
Oh, I write a lot of my notes longhand. When I travel, for instance, I have huge files of pieces of paper with handwriting on them. Yeah. That's sort of the beginning. And when I do a book review, it's all handwritten first, but all sort of in fragments. You know, it doesn't start the first paragraph and end. It's all sort of broken up paragraphs. And then one day I'll sit at the computer and organize it and put it all together into something that's like a first draft.
Do you find that you write differently if you're writing longhand or in the old days on a typewriter or on word processing?
Well, I always wrote longhand. I mean, I just took it to a typewriter. But I always wrote in longhand. Many poets write in longhand.
And do you find that you do that? I'm curious if you think that you write differently when you write in longhand than when you write at a keyboard.
Oh, I don't know. These things are sort of trivial. I think people always asking, like, do you write with, a pen or a pencil and so forth? I guess it's some bedrock of curiosity, but it's probably not too important.
Blueing?
No, I don't think it's too much different.
Joyce Carol Oates, her new novel is called The Sacrifice. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up next, political activist and many-time presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Stay with us. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and for all the 50th anniversaries of news events we've been recognizing in recent months, here's another one not to forget. It was 1965 when Ralph Nader came to prominence with his transformative book about the auto industry, Unsafe at Any Speed. Nader, of course, went on to launch many consumer and citizen action groups and to run for president 5 times, including most recently as an independent in 2008 and most famously in 2000 when the 100,000 votes he got in Florida may have been the difference, one of the game changers at least, between Bush and Gore. Now Ralph Nader has a new book, Return to Sender, Unanswered Letters to the President, 2001 to 2015. Ralph, thanks so much for coming on again. Welcome back to WNYC.
As always, thank you, Brian.
We'll get to some of your letters, but first, are you running for president next year?
No.
How much of a Bernie Sanders fan are you, and might you endorse him for the Democratic nomination?
I think he's got a very good program. He's going to talk about it day after day all over the country. He was launched with 5,000 cheering supporters in his state of Vermont last week. The question is whether he's going to really take on Hillary, or whether that's going to be left to former Governor Martin O'Malley, who announced for president on Saturday in Baltimore.
What would it mean to take on Hillary?
It would mean more than just repeating on the six debates that are scheduled by the Democratic National Committee, Bernie's progressive agenda. It would basically challenge her to defend her Wall Street and militaristic record and challenge her to support the kinds of things that have majoritarian support that are listed in Bernie's proposal, from living wage to full Medicare for all with free choice of doctor and hospital, pulling back on the empire and taxing Wall Street transactions and putting Main Street above Wall Street. So he's got to confront her. He doesn't have to be harsh, but he simply can't go on a parallel track with her on these debates.
You know, I asked Bernie Sanders last fall why he might run in Democratic primaries rather than as an independent, which, of course, he's always been. And his answer included a reference to you. So here's that excerpt from last September, 40 seconds of Bernie Sanders at a climate policy event here in New York when I asked him that question.
Here's the issue, as I see it. Can we, in fact, put together an effective grassroots third-party movement in America? And it's... And the answer is maybe. And the answer is maybe not. Chris talked about somebody I've known for many years, Ralph Nader. And I remember Ralph. Ralph is an old friend, brilliant guy who has done enormous things for this country. But I remember during his campaign, and somebody correct me if I'm wrong, Ralph got up and said, there's no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. We need a new party. Didn't happen.
What would you say to your old friend, Bernie Sanders?
Well, he's recognizing the two-party tyranny that blocks third parties from getting on ballots, sues them, repeatedly drains their efforts, keeps them off the debates. The only way that third-party candidates, unless you're a billionaire like Ross Perot, can ever reach tens of millions of Americans. That's why he's going to have to register as a Democrat and run inside the Democratic Party, where he gets on the ballot, in effect, automatically. He gets on 6 debates during the primary season, and he tries to turn the party away from its corporatist and militarist backing into more progressive fields. So I understand his tactics, and he doesn't want to split the vote.
So one of the unanswered letters in your book, I see, of unanswered letters to Presidents Bush and Obama, is to President Obama just last December, titled Still Hoping for Hope and Change. How much hope and change do you think he has brought?
He has not brought anywhere near what he was proposing in 2008. He proposed a higher minimum wage and then forgot about it, never mentioned it until 2012, when a few thousand people began picketing and some think tanks began writing. He's been very preoccupied with the war on terrorism, very preoccupied with the Federal Reserve and the recession, properly so. But he hasn't spent any time shifting power from the few to the many with campaign finance reform, stronger labor union rights, and strengthening consumers and small taxpayers so they can stand up for themselves. We have all these concrete proposals in the book, Return to Sender.
That letter was partly an appeal to the president for him to oppose the Pacific Rim trade agreement that he's now, of course, heavily promoting. He says if we don't take part in setting the rules for trade with Asia, China will set them to our disadvantage, like keeping our goods and services from having as much of a chance in the big markets over there. How much do you think he has a point about that?
He doesn't. First of all, we have the World Trade Organization. That's supposed to liberalize trade. The second is what I really criticize him for. He knows full well this is not just a trade agreement. Only about 8 chapters out of 29 chapters of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement have anything to do with trade. What they do is they put trade on top of the domestic standards for consumer protection, labor protections, and environmental health. That's the whole point of these globalized trade agreements written by global corporate lobbyists and their corporate lawyers. It's to basically sidestep our own courts, legislature, and regulatory agencies and make any advance in the consumer worker and environmental area a non-tariff trade barrier, which means that we either have to not advance or repeal some of these standards, or we can be punished with fines and with retaliation. So this is basically setting up an ever tighter transnational system of autocratic governance where the conflicts between the USA and other countries are decided literally, Brian, in secret tribunals, not in our open courts. And so Obama really ought to be ashamed of himself. He was formerly a lecturer in constitutional law, University of Chicago, and he knows full well that this is not just about reducing quotas and tariffs. It's about replacing our own control over our country's standards and pulling them down to lower standards abroad so that our jobs and industries can be shipped to fascist and communist dictatorships such as China and other countries.
You know, different people on different points on the political spectrum seem to use the national sovereignty issue at different times. Like, I think progressives sometimes like the fact that there are binding international treaties and think there should be more international law and human rights and things like that, and not have countries hide behind sovereignty on everything.
Well, you can do that in the following way. If we want to increase labor conditions around the world, we have labor treaties. If we want to advance environmental positions around the world, we have environmental treaties. If we want to do something about the price of medicines and patents, we have consumer treaties, especially dealing with China exporting so many hazardous foods and medicines to the U.S. But you don't subordinate with penalties our country's right to advance its own consumer, worker, and environmental conditions. You don't subordinate it to the dictates of international commercial trade. And that's what's going on. This is a political governance situation, not just trade. And so the press has got to wake up to this. They keep reporting trans-Pacific trade, trade, trade. That's not the main point. The main point is to pull our country down by subordinating our ability to be first in the world. Like if we had these trade agreements, Brian, years ago, we couldn't have gotten airbags in cars. We would have had to go to an international harmonization committee, meeting in secret and sandpapering auto safety standards down to the lowest common denominator of the signatory nations.
My guest is Ralph Nader. His new book is Return to Sender, Unanswered Letters to the President, 2001 to 2015. And, of course, you're famous for starting many civic groups. And I see that one of your letters in 2012 asked, why won't President Obama speak to civic groups? What's his practice on that?
You picked one of the most important letters. Thank you, Brian. He has gone all over the country and the world promoting U.S. manufactured goods. Like he went to India to promote Harley-Davidson motorcycles and Boeing airplanes, and he'll go around the country and have photo opportunities in factories. So I thought I'd write him a letter. And by the way, a letter is the most democratic media. People writing letters to their elected officials, these cannot be censored or distorted. That's why one of the reasons I wrote the book is to encourage people to engage in correspondence with their governors, mayors, senators, representatives, president, you name it. Anyway, so I suggested that he go three blocks from the White House to a hotel ballroom, which would be full of 1,000 leaders of nonprofit groups. These are religious charities, environmental, consumer, labor, social service, children's groups, and so on, and make a historic speech about this voluntary sector in the country, which, by the way, employs a lot of people, and encourage people to support these groups who have millions of members around the country, and encourage people to expand these services. And, of course, that would, as a byproduct, create more jobs. Well, he never answered the letter. So I sent a copy over to Michelle Obama's office, and she wrote back basically saying, thank you, but he's too busy. Well, he's too busy to reach out. I mean, these are many of his own voters, for heaven's sake. So this is the lack of priorities and the way Obama has catered to the rich and powerful. He raised twice as much as Senator McCain did from Wall Street in 2008. No one's ever done that from the Democratic Party. Cater to the rich and powerful, but not people who are doing the daily wonderful work in this country, but don't have a lot of checks to write to politicians.
So on this idea of citizens doing political organizing, my producer did a little audio archaeology, and they came up with a clip of you from the early 1970s when you were on the Mike Douglas television show with John Lennon.
Yes.
And John Lennon, you remember this, just asked you about your book, Action for Change, A Student's Manual for Public Interest Organizing, from that era in which you give step-by-step instructions to students who want to enact political change. So I thought people would like to hear, maybe even you would like to hear, a minute of you and John Lennon from the early 1970s.
So the first part of the book is devoted to showing exactly step-by-step how they can organize this type of statewide action group from their own funds. I mean, like what we tell them quite clearly, for example, that they spend on the average about $250 a year on soft drinks, cigarettes, and candies. Yeah. If they just spend 3% or 2% of that, $2, $3, $4 a year, they could develop the strongest democratic force in the state.
Yeah. Hmm.
And they could also work with people who aren't students, retired people who have a lot of time and a lot of talent on their hands.
You tell them to register to vote as well.
Register
because
to
vote.
Because
that's been a great change in the whole movement. People, a lot of people were saying voting's irrelevant, and a few years ago, and a lot of movement people have decided that voting is relevant because it's the only chance they're going to get. Like, if you want to beat the establishment, you got to know how it works.
Well, you'll be more likely to want to vote, particularly at a younger age, if you know what the issues are and if you can push for a real choice between different candidates.
John Lennon, public affairs interviewer.
And that result of that book was forming the public interest research groups and the New York Public Interest Issues Group in New York City and throughout the state has done great work in the last 40-some years, and there are 20 of them all over the country now, providing students with the kind of civic engagement and civic skills and experience that they never get in the curriculum at the universities and colleges. So it wasn't just a theoretical fling here. It's actually helping New Yorkers, and one of the spinoffs was to improve the New York subway system, the Strap Hangers Group, which still operates very effectively.
Which came out of, the group NYPIRG, Public Interest Research Group. So there were ones, people don't know this history in large measure, all over the country, launched by you. Do you think that that's your greatest accomplishment, starting these many private public interest groups around the country?
Certainly up in the top five, because thousands of young people, when they graduated, had civic self-confidence, and they didn't go through life saying you can't fight City Hall or Exxon Mobil. So there's a lot of good consequences from that, and I wish more university trustees and presidents would approve these kinds of checkoffs on the tuition bill based on a student referendum to set up these nonprofit groups, and they're run by students elected by their fellow students. They're independent institutions.
Claude in the Bronx, you're on WNYC with Ralph Nader. Hi, Claude.
Hey, I just want to say it's a huge honor. I, in 2004, called Green Party people to try to get you elected and got yelled at by Greens because of 2000. My question is, you said that it's almost impossible for people to get third-party candidates on the debates unless they're billionaires like Ross Perot. What do you think will have to happen, or what will the people have to do to make that a possibility? Because I feel, with that experience in 2004, most of the people were just so uninformed.
Well, there are two things that are happening for 2016. One is a group led by George Farah, F-A-R-A-H, who's a New York lawyer, and he wrote a book on the debate commission exposing it as a corporate tool of the two parties designed to exclude competition and more voices and choices for the voters out there. So that's going to be revived again. And the other new one is that former members of Congress, Republican Vince Weber and Democrat Lee Hamilton, have formed a group, and they've now put two full-page ads in the New York Times saying that the debate commission has got to broaden its rules and bring more candidates on and have more debates so that more people are exposed to more ideas and the system is put to an end. I mean, right now it's run by the two parties. They decide how many debates, which reporters are going to ask the questions, who's going to be in the audience. It's pretty rigged and pretty shameless.
He mentioned getting yelled at Greens for supporting you in 2004 because of what happened in 2000. I don't want to rehash all that, but I do want to ask one detail of the 2000 presidential run. Reading some history about it, it seems like in the final weeks, you could have campaigned mostly in safe blue states like New York to not threaten Gore's chances and run up your own popular vote to 5%, which would have gotten you federal funding for your next campaign. But instead, you focused on swing states like Florida with fewer votes for you but a higher chance of giving the election to Bush. Did you do that on purpose as a long-term strategy of showing the Democrats the power of progressive independence?
Actually, that's factually mistaken, Brian, and I know that's the current misimpression. The documentary that was done independent of me, called An Unreasonable Man, exposed those mistakes. I spent 28 days in California, a pretty blue state, 2 days in Florida. So you can see, and there's more evidence like that. I was trying to get 5% of the vote. and to try in order to get federal funds on the next round and set up a third force. And you don't do that campaigning in Florida when you can campaign in more progressive areas of California. But let's remember, 250,000 Democrats in Florida voted for Bush. There were a lot of shenanigans taking the election in Florida away from Gore. Gore won the popular vote. In most countries, that gets you the victory, but the Electoral College took it away from him. If he just won his home state of Tennessee and everything was the same, he'd have been president. There are all kinds of sine qua non, so it's pretty bad to blame a third party that basically represents a lot of majoritarian positions and is willing to give them all to the two parties if they would pick them up. And that's what we did. So I believe that voters should have more choices, more voices. That's the way to have a competitive, healthy democracy. We don't have that.
All of those things happened, Tennessee, everything else in 2000. But why not, because in Florida, you know, officially Gore lost by a few hundred votes. You got 100,000 votes. Why not embrace that as a warning to Democrats to not take their most progressive flanks for granted and say, look what I did. Don't mess with this group of Americans.
Well, but that's flowing from a mistaken base of history, because the recount, I think, which was ordered by the Florida Supreme Court and blocked 5-4 by the political decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, I think that would have come out in favor of Gore, because there were just too many shenanigans, especially in southern Florida counties. However, you make a good point. A third party can say to one or two parties, we're going to compete with you, and you better take a look at our agenda. That's what Bernie Sanders would have done had he run as an independent. Now he's inside the Democratic Party. He's got to develop a new strategy in order to put similar pressures on the corporatist, militarist Democratic Party.
Last thing. This is the 50th anniversary of Unsafe at Any Speed. Looking back, how do you think that landmark book of yours changed not just automotive design, but also government safety regulation in general?
I think it was quite transformative, and I have to pay tribute to the media and the talk shows who helped as well. And it basically raised the question, how do we democratize technology of all kind to protect people's health, safety, and privacy, and not let the corporations use the new technologies to advance their own narrow commercial interests? And as you know, Brian, that debate continues on your program and other programs, and I was pleased to have a start in raising that very, very important question for the well-being of the American people. It goes right into, you know, whether we're going to put more highways or more public transit, whether we're going to control the toxics of air, water, pollution, contaminated food, whether we're going to curb the side effects, deadly side effects of too many medicines and antibiotic resistance, all the way to the way we're going to deal with the environment and climate change. So solar energy conversion. That's all that really started stirring up in the 1960s. And I'm glad that they paid attention to Unsafe at Any Speed, which is, as you say, is coming up for its 50th anniversary in November. I hope we can have a big celebration in New York City. I think that would be a nice way not only to remember history, but to look forward and build on that history.
You want everybody to drive their safe cars into Manhattan. No, I'm kidding. Ralph Nader's new book is called Return to Sender, Unanswered Letters to the President, 2001 to 2015. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the past and future of the so-called Borscht Belt in the Catskills. It's the Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and many of you remember that the movie Dirty Dancing was set in the Catskills in the summer of 1963. The romance and dancing unfolded at the fictional Kellerman's Resort, a nod to the popular hotels that catered to a Jewish clientele in the Catskills, the heyday of the Borscht Belt, as that area was called for its East European Jewish roots, is long gone. But if Baby and Johnny Castle wanted to rekindle their romance in a casino in a few years, they could return to the Catskills.
You don't have to go to Atlantic City. You don't have to go to Massachusetts. You don't have to go to Connecticut. You stay right here in New York. You just look north a little bit, and you go to Sullivan County.
That was Governor Cuomo in a news conference touting the announcement of the three casinos approved for upstate New York. The one in Sullivan County will be the closest to New York City. That's instead of Orange County, which was the closest proposal that some people expected to be approved. So we're going to spend a few minutes now talking about the past and the future of the Borscht Belt in Sullivan County and what this $1.1 billion resort and casino project may mean for the area. Joining us first is Marissa Scheinfeld, a photographer who grew up in the Catskills. For the past few years, she's been returning to these resort ruins and photographing what she finds. She sent us some of her beautiful and sometimes eerie images, and we've posted them on our website at WNYC.org. If you want to see some Catskills photos, WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, and we'll discuss them here as we go along. Hello, Marissa. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for having me.
And in a few minutes, we'll turn to what might make a casino successful at the site of the old Concord. But we know this area of the Catskills was known as the Borscht Belt. It was called the Jewish Alps sometimes. Sullivan County was sometimes called Solomon County or Solomon Country. Why was the area so attractive to Jewish vacationers from New York City in the early 20th century to start out with, and then going through most of the 20th century? How did it become so?
Sure. Well, the Borscht Belt's history is very interesting, but it was born in the 1920s. In that period of time, Jews were banned from hotels in the United States. The county had already slowly been developing, having two previous industries, and the Borscht Belt industry kind of started from farms that became boarding houses. Farmers in the county realized that they could supplement their income by having boarders come stay who had heard of the beauty of the county, which is still there and will be revived with the casinos and all the new events happening there. And slowly but surely, an industry of over 600 hotels started in the 1920s, boomed in the 1950s, and by the mid-60s, it did teeter off. I grew up in the area in 1986. My parents moved up there from Brooklyn and spent a lot of time at those hotels as a kid, the Concord being one of the hotels that I went to almost every weekend with my grandparents. And it was unavoidable to hear a story about the Borscht Belt, about the comedy, about the food, about the leisure, about the pools. I played shuffleboard and, you know, experienced a little bit of it in its dying days. And as a kid, it didn't dawn on me how epic and huge the era was. But since embarking on this project for the past 4 years and looking for relics of the era and finding bits of it that have been left over almost as eyesores, I've discovered a lot. And like you mentioned, and I appreciate your words, captured a very eerie and almost sublime beauty in the leftovers of the era.
You ask how epic, how huge. Here's how, according to some of the numbers you gave us off the air, that there were over 500 hotels in Sullivan County at the height of the Borscht Belt's popularity. And there were, was it 1,000 additional cabins?
Bungalow colonies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So why did it decline? What happened?
I think that you can't just say it was one thing. It was a multitude of ingredients. Some say the birth of the airline industry or the boom of the airline industry in the 1970s. I think there were also shifts. People did not necessarily want to go to a hotel with the same thing year after year. You know, my father is a great example of someone who went to those hotels as a kid, and by 1969, 1970, he wanted to get on a plane and go to Paris instead of go up every single weekend. And there was a lot of changes going on in the world and in the country at that time. But I think the most simplest term is everything has its day.
So the Montrain Resort and Casino, did I say that right? Montrain?
Yes.
Is the only one approved for the Catskills or Hudson Valley region. It'll be at the site or near the site of the old Concord Hotel, one of the best known higher end resorts. We call the Concord a higher end resort.
Oh, right? Definitely. It was one of what they call the fortress resorts.
Yeah, which meant what? What was there that was not at some of the lower-end ones?
The Concorde had, you know, a golf course. It had these beautiful tree-lined driveways, pools, indoor pools, outdoor pools, saunas, steam rooms. It was, you didn't ever have to leave.
And we have on our website a photograph that you took of what used to be the Concorde. What would we see in this photo?
You would see the period of time that I captured the Concorde, which was after it was demolished. The Concorde sold off all of the furniture, then it was used as a fireman training camp, and then they leveled the hotel. So my images of the hotel are literally piles of rubble.
Yeah, it's like a pile of twisted metal that I think I'm looking at here.
Yeah,
right?
It is just like deformed and rusting with time and seasons and change.
And so it's going to be a long road to put that back together into a gleaming new casino resort hotel.
It is, but what you have is a county that is capable and has showed itself many times to reemerge with a new industry. The Borscht Belt was actually the third major industry of the county, and you have a very deserving group of people that have been working very hard with a lot of hope to reinvigorate and bring people back up to the county, which is really an hour and a half from where we sit and offers so much. Obviously, it will offer a casino, but its beauty and the natural environment is definitely something worth visiting as well.
Another of your photographs is of a lawn chair at the old Grossinger's Catskill Resort and Hotel, and it's on what looks like an indoor pool deck, and the deck is just covered in moss. It's really beautiful in a way, although it also speaks to neglect and decay. Tell us about Grossinger's and this photograph.
Sure. Grossinger's closed in the late 80s. It wasn't a hotel that I had visited. I have visited dozens and dozens of hotels while working on this. But what you have is this indoor pool where the floor has literally become moss. There was once green carpet. And what's very interesting to me is the absence of people, but what has happened, whether by nature or people who have been going through the spaces, moving things around, changing things, demolishing things. And it very much speaks to, you know, contemporary actions, whether they're done by nature or man.
Do you think that if this casino works, that it would attract a largely Jewish clientele there once again? I know you mentioned to us off the air that there's now an Orthodox Jewish community that's growing in
Very large Orthodox Jewish community that has purchased many of the hotels and bungalow colonies.
And new dynamics that have created some tensions in the community.
I think there's just, naturally a separation with the locals and the Orthodox community, which tends to keep to itself. So I hope that the casinos, I'm sure, will bring back people who had once been to the Borscht Belt, maybe even their kids or their grandkids. But I hope it brings back young people like myself who are looking for a place to go not too far from New York City, maybe different from the Hamptons vibe, and somewhere where they could, you know, go for a weekend and come back very easily.
All right, let's hear a little oral history. Barbara in the Bronx used to have a bungalow there.
Yes. Hi, Brian. Love the show.
Thank you.
Yes. A Gentile from the Bronx, my father always had a job for the summer in the orchestra of one of the big hotels, and we were allowed to use the amenities, but we lived in a bungalow colony, and we were always the only Gentile in the entire bungalow colony, the only Gentile family.
So you could turn the lights on and off on Saturdays, right?
We were never asked to do that, oddly enough. A person couldn't turn on their own lights, but I know that from having visited the Jewish Museum down in Lower Manhattan, that was, you know, a common practice to get the Gentiles to switch on and off all the lights. But in my case, in one of the bungalow colonies where we stayed, they were very Orthodox, and they came and visited us one night to explain that in order to have their religious services on Saturday mornings on the premises, they had to own. Jewish law stated that they had to own all the property, and so we had to symbolically sell our bungalow to them for 5 cents.
Oh.
So naturally we did that. And then they had several feasts during the summer where, you know, people would come and have a communal table of all these foods and wines and specialties and all that. and they loved my mother's Italian sauce.
All right. Thank
you
very
much. They were really crazy about it.
Italian sauce on the Blintzes. I don't know if it goes, but maybe it goes. Barbara, thank you very much. Well, Marissa, we'll have to do a separate segment someday, just a little explainer about the Shabbos Goy and where that came from, as it's called, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where, because if you're very observant, you can't do any work.
You can't do any work.
On the Sabbath, even turning on a light switch.
Yes.
But Alan on Long Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alan.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Leonard. And I love the show. I've listened to NPR all my life. When I was 12, growing up as a Jew in Brooklyn, my dad, who was a lawyer and had some money, decided that it would be time for us to spend our entire summers up at the various hotels. And we went from the Shanks Hotel to the Majestic to the Big Time at the Nemerson. And by the time they were ready to finish it, I had already graduated from high school. And we played in a rock band at the Nemerson Hotel, and it was a wonderful way to spend the summers. But a very interesting story. The Shanks Hotel was located right down the block from the Raleigh Hotel. And the Raleigh was a much higher level of hotel than we were. Also catered mostly to the Jewish people coming up from the city. And on a Friday night toward the end of the summer, they had planned the Young Rascals with Felix Cavalieri to come up there. And I was a musician at the time, and we were all excited. So we got our tickets for $4, and me and my friend were going to see the Young Rascals. And we walked down the street to the Raleigh. There was a big sign on the gate that said, due to Felix Cavalieri getting the flu, they were canceling the concert, but they were offering to exchange the tickets for a group that nobody had ever heard of playing at the Delano Motor Lounge, which required a car ride.
Oh.
It was a very small, low-grade hotel.
Who's it going to be? What year was it?
67.
Okay.
The name of the group was Led Zeppelin. And we said, nah, we're not going to bother with that.
Whoever heard of them. Okay, good story. Led Zeppelin plays the Catskills. I wonder how their one-liners were. One more. Mitchell in Manhattan, you still go?
Hi, Brian. I'm here, yes. Thank you so much for your show every day.
Love
it.
Thank you.
Yeah, just a little on the Borscht Belt, you know, talk about one-liners. What's made it so famous for me in my life, I was born in Queens in Forest Hills and raised in Connecticut, so I wasn't part of the Jewish life up there. But what did bring me there is really through comedy and the incredibly rich beginnings of Jewish humor, not beginnings, but you could say promulgation mm-hmm. of Jewish humor out to the rest of the world from these great big old Jewish hotels from the Borscht Belt. You know, everybody started there. And, you know, they came up to the Borscht Belt to become waiters and everything. And before you know it, they were on stage making jokes, you know, Henny Youngman, everybody began there.
Yeah.
But my main contact with that part of the world in the Catskills is related to an old Jewish hotel called the Bel Air that became a yoga center, Shivananda Yoga Center. And Yoga Ranch people come up from New York now to go do yoga up in the Catskills there,
mm-hmm.
right smack in the middle of the Orthodox community.
Mitchell, thank you very much. So spirituality survives in the old Borscht Belt, but in different forms than in the 1920s through 60s or 70s. And by the way, we're not going to have time for Marvin in Old Bridge, but he's calling to say that the Catskills is still currently the fly fishing mecca for the East Coast. Did you know that?
It is. There's an entire fly fishing museum up there.
And thank you so much for your oral history and for your photographs of the Catskills that people can see on our page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
So what about tomorrow? Joining us now, Alan Woynski, editor of Gaming Industry Daily. What does it take to build a casino at the site of the old Concord Hotel? And what would it take to make it successful? Alan, welcome to WNYC.
Good morning.
First of all, the decision to leave out Orange County, which is closer to New York City, was a surprise to a lot of people who were expecting it to be there. What do you think of the choice of Sullivan County from an industry standpoint, a little further up?
Well, I you know, all along I knew that at least one of the licenses were going to Sullivan County. It was a question of whether, you know, it kind of diminished the chance at profitability by also giving a license to a casino in Orange County. Now, the big problem is you kind of gave up a little bit on the revenue side by only giving one license and by not picking one in Orange County, because obviously the proximity to New York City. In the end, I don't think it was a wrong choice. Two may have been too many. But, you know, it remains to be seen what happens mostly with what's going to go on in northern New Jersey in the future.
In northern New Jersey?
Yes.
Now, of course, Orange County would have been a little closer than Sullivan County is to Atlantic City. Is the Catskills, Sullivan County, far enough away to be significantly less competitive with the Jersey Shore?
Well, Atlantic City kind of lost the northern part a long time ago, and that was mainly, for example, Bergen County, New Jersey, which is where I'm from.
Mm-hmm.
It's 70 minutes to go to Sands Bethlehem. It's half an hour to go to Yonkers Raceway, the VLT is there. It's about an hour or so to go to Resorts World at Aqueduct. Then you have 2 hours, more or less to the north to go to Foxwoods or Mohegan Sun, 2 hours to Atlantic City. So in my area, there's not many people making regular trips to Atlantic City anymore because, yeah, quite frankly, there's closer places.
And more attractive places, probably, for what the
is there. That's kind of like beauty's in the eye of the beholder there. I don't really think people go to casinos anymore just because of what they offer. I think it has definitely become the closer property gets the bulk of the business.
Right. So what about the unique situation of the Catskills as this area on one level that's the woods, hiking and biking trails and lakes and parks? Does a casino fit into that differently than other places? And is that something that they could market that some of the others that you mentioned can't?
Well, obviously it's an area that has wanted casinos for a long time. I remember my parents had a house up in Roxbury Run, New York, and I remember driving up there and always seeing the signs, casinos mean jobs. This is before I even really knew what a casino was.
Mm-hmm.
And now I look at it as it's a little late. If they had done this 15, 20 years ago, it would have been, it would have been a guaranteed success. But now, casinos are only as good as their target feeder market, and the most important thing is how much competition. So now with the Northeast having a lot more casinos basically than any other area, you really have a smaller area to draw from on a regular basis, and then obviously in the summer, depending on what they're going to offer there, if everything comes to pass with what they're talking about there, you're probably going to get more visitation in the summer because you're going to be able to offer more, and obviously the climate. But when it comes down to it, I mean, I tell people this all the time, and I know the industry people don't like it when I say this. It doesn't matter if the slot machine you're playing is in, a racetrack or a billion-dollar casino.
Mm.
People are going to go to the nearest slot machine, not the nicest property.
You think that's it? So there isn't a kind of hiking and gambling industry to invent here. It's going to
There is.
Yeah.
There is, but only a few months a year.
Right.
Nobody's going to go there in January
for that.
And do that.
Right. Yes. And, of course, it's going to be a year-round facility. I'm reading that it's going to be an 18-story hotel. It'll have an indoor-outdoor water park, a conference center, and a resort. It's a $1 billion project on 1,700 acres. So it's not going to be a bungalow colony with slot machines. It's going to be a year-round luxury resort, right?
Right, but then you run into how many people are going to come there to gamble, how many people are going to come there for the resort. Now, obviously, for the area, it doesn't matter. As long as you draw the people, the whole area is going to benefit. But casinos, it's been proven now over and over again, casinos that focus more on non-gaming are casinos that don't make it. I mean, all of the casinos that have gone bankrupt over the years, over the last few years, from Revel, the Cosmopolitan was just sold in Las Vegas for, a lot less than it cost to build. These were all casinos that focused more on non-gaming than on gaming.
There is the challenge for the coming casino to Sullivan County in the Catskills, as announced by the state of New York. Alan Woynski, editor of Gaming Industry Daily, thank you very much for the insight.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll be back live on Monday.